You're listening to episode 9 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with Jim Pinto of Alderac Entertainment Group. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 6 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name's Wayne.
My name is Chris.
And we have joining us today, Jim Pinto.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jim.
Glad to have you with us, Jim. We'll be introducing Jim here in just a second. But before we explain who Jim is, for anyone who's not familiar with his name, I have to first explain something about Zinger sitting in front of me.
Yes.
Because Chad is baffled by the way in which I consume.
No, I'm not baffled. You just eat them incorrectly.
No, I eat them correctly. For anyone who's not familiar with a Zinger,
tough.
Take one for the team.
It's a Twinkie with icing only.
Yeah, it's a Twinkie.
100 times better.
Yeah, I was going to say Twinkie is just not as good. So
Twinkie is mainstream, though. People will know a Twinkie.
Twinkie That's is true. Mainstream, yeah. Zingers are they're the indie treat.
They're the food of the gods.
Do you guys remember when Zingers were Dolly Madison when we were kids? And now,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now they're Hostess.
Charlie Brown specials. And you would sit and you'd watch a Charlie Brown special. Pick your holiday. They had one. And every commercial was essentially a Dolly Madison commercial for either Zingers or whatever, you know, cupcakes they had. And then if you were lucky, they would have Star Wars action figure commercials in there as well.
I'm sitting here eating a Zinger. And the way I opt to eat my Zinger is I turn them upside down, eat the cake part first, leaving the icing and cream, which I then consume last.
With this messed up, sort of chewed on layer of, you know, cake.
It's kind of funny because it's the opposite of what I do. I eat the icing first, and then I have a Zinger without icing left.
But let me
next.
Ask you something.
At least you peel the icing off, and it's nice and clean.
I peel it off with my tongue.
Ew. Chris is excited.
It's hot.
When you go to dinner, you eat your vegetables before your dessert. It's the same reason I eat the crust of grilled cheese before I eat the grilled cheese. You get it done with.
You just, so you're
you
saying,
but what if you have the dessert there and it's melting? Then
so
I'll
Dan,
eat the dessert first.
What are you saying? Are you saying that 90% of Zinger is green beans?
Yeah, fair enough. All right. But what I was going to tell you guys that you said I had to start recording for was there was a study. And I realize saying there was a study is about right up there with saying I was reading Nostradamus.
Chad, do you like Zingers? You like Zingers. We had a study.
But there was a study that came out of France several years ago that said women should not date men who eat their food systematically. So, for example,
was this in like the French version of Cosmo? I mean, come on.
But they said, for example, let's say I give you a dinner that has like a steak, green beans, and mashed potatoes. If you eat all the mashed potatoes, then all the green beans, then all the steak, so you're a systematic eater,
right?
That it's a sign that you have or tends to correlate with certain emotional issues and lack of spontaneity.
Aren't you a systematic eater?
Oh, yeah, big time. Totally. Yeah.
What does it say if you cut the meat, put the mashed potatoes on, and then put the vegetables on top of that and eat it all at once?
It says gross, is what that says.
You know what Dan used to do? And I've actually seen one or two other people do this, but not many, is French fries and ketchup, right? Mm-hmm. And he doesn't put his salt on his French fries. He puts his salt in his ketchup. And then slather
it. I used to do that.
I haven't seen you do that in a long time.
I don't
time.
Do it anymore for simple reason that in the interest of not getting high blood pressure,
right,
I don't use salt for much of anything. But anyway, let's get back to what we're supposed to be doing. Jim, would you take a couple minutes?
Oh, yeah. We got this Jim guy. What's that all about?
Would you give us a couple minutes to, one, tell us why you're undateable, and then, two, give us something of a resume of who you are and what you've done in the gaming industry.
Well, I'm undateable because I'm a systematic stalker, not a systematic eater.
I think
women kind of frown down on that, the systematic stalking.
And what is your system so I can take notes and give them to Pat later?
I have a whole little timeline of everything that she's going to be doing and where she's going to be so that I can actually meet her at the places rather than follow her to the places.
Nice.
Cool, very
nice.
Clever.
Women underestimate the commitment that a stalker can bring over a normal boyfriend.
Right.
What, I mean, a normal boyfriend, he'll maybe get you flowers if it's maybe a special occasion. Whereas a stalker knows everything about you.
You're important.
Yeah,
to him.
You are the focus.
He cares about you.
A stalker gets you flowers and a really, really wonderfully worded, some might say creepy, poem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe even cut out from letters in a magazine.
I wonder.
That takes time.
And a stalker won't cheat on you.
I wonder how many people are out there, because you always hear about the really terrible stalker experiences between guys or girls, doesn't matter. And, you know, they wouldn't leave me alone. They obsessed about me. They just always were thinking about me. They were always around, which isn't that what almost all girls want? But they have you ever heard of the good stalker stories? The ones where the girl was like, yeah, he was a stalker, but I didn't have anything else going on.
Actually, yes.
I'm thinking of one right now.
Yeah.
I have not heard many, and it would take me a while to even remember one, but I have known a couple people where that's how it started. One person was stalking the other, and eventually the other party kind of came around.
Came around. That is creepier defenses. Than an actual stalker to me.
I think that's how Val Kilmer got together with his wife, actually. If you go and you read the story online, Joanne Wally Kilmer, his first wife.
Yeah, that was his co-star from Willow, yeah.
Yeah. He was bugging her every day on the set. He would not leave her alone, and eventually she just broke down and went out with him.
Oh, my gosh.
Let me get this straight. The guy who showed up on his future wife's doorstep at, like, 1 or 2 in the morning wondering if there's a positive stalker experience.
Knocked on her bedroom window at 3 o'clock in the morning to express my love for her.
Yeah, because that's not less creepy.
Hey, you know, if she would have told me to get bent, I would have been out of there. See, I don't have the commitment of a stalker.
All right, so Jim, you've answered question number one. Let's move to question number two.
I was going to claim to have invented the Twinkie, but...
but you're off.
Yeah.
Oh, we were dissing Twinkie, yeah.
I don't think I can really pull that one off, especially after claiming to invent the internet and things of that nature. So I got started with Shadus Magazine. I've been a game designer / editor / writer / art director in the gaming industry for about 12 years now. And I got started with Shadus Magazine back in 96. And I've actually, by this time now, I've had my name in just about every kind of credit that I can have it in.
So as an art director, let me ask you a question. Other than Keith Curtis, do you know any illustrators that actually finish their work?
There's tons of guys. They're all A-level echelon, really expensive illustrators. But you'll find now in the industry that there's so little work going around that the people that have stuck around are all really, really professional.
So really? A better way to put it is, do you have any tips for getting one to complete the work?
So what you're telling me is that I could get Keith Parkinson to do a comic right now.
Well, Keith Parkinson passed away, but yes.
Oh.
That would be very difficult.
No. Yeah.
So he's really available. There's nothing on his calendar at all.
Yeah. His calendar's wide open.
Jim, you gave an extremely abbreviated resume of yourself, but talk a little bit about Alderac then. When you joined Shadus, though, you were with Alderac at the time that Shadus was being published, right?
Yeah. And I've all, my tenure in the industry has pretty much been a 99% Alderac. I worked with Green Ronin for a short time, with Zeitgeist for a short time, and I still do some freelance for Goodman here and there, but pretty much all with AEG. And so I went from Shadus Magazine as an assistant editor, moved right into the editor-in-chief position at Shadus because Rob was moving on to writing for the L5R role-playing game and then eventually the 7th Sea role-playing game. And after Shadus folded, went on sabbatical and never came back, I moved on to editing, writing, and then finally art direction at AEG. And I was art director there for 6 years.
Let's talk a little bit about Shadus, because I have had several people say to me, Chris being one of them, but Chris is not reliable. One, because he's Chris, and two, because he used to write for the magazine.
Right.
But I've had a couple people tell me that they think that Shadus was one of the best gaming magazines out there, and they were really sorry to see it go. What happened to take it under?
We were actually really cool. Let me address that first. Shadus was the only independent magazine of its type at the time. Anybody else that had tried to be independent always felt the fervor of the industry pounding on their doors and saying, you're not making enough profit, go away. And so Shadus for a long time was able to fill the niche of both role players and collectible card gamers. And then when the decision was made not to do CCG work anymore because the company was doing the Legend of the Five Rings CCG, so in order to maintain their independence, they just focus on role-playing games. I think that was the beginning of the decline as role-playing games pre-3rd edition D&D were seeing the end of their renaissance, if you will.
Was it just a decline? I mean, was it really just a decline in the audience that kind of put the magazine down then? There just wasn't enough sales going on?
I mean, you know, I can certainly take a lot of the blame for it simply because I stepped into a position not realizing what was going on with the magazine. You know, I went from assistant editor knowing very little about the condition of the company or the magazine to editor-in-chief within 3 months. And I didn't realize that things were already sort of in decline with the magazine and that I needed to do drastic things to turn it around. And I was moving at a much slower pace than I should have been as an editor. This is all hindsight now, obviously. There's no way I would have known better at the time. I think even if you told me, you know, you need to really do something with this magazine, I don't know that I would have done much different than I was doing. In hindsight now, I would have loved to have turned it into the mouthpiece for a whole new fresh game world. And every month you got more pieces of that game world and more information and storylines and events going on in that environment. I think that would have been groundbreaking in 1996.
That was going to be my next question, is if you were editor-in-chief, what was the time frame that it actually went under? Because you said it was about the time that CCGs picked up, which put me in the mid to late 90s, but where exactly did it go under?
The magazine went under, I want to say, at the end of 97. Issue 54 was the last one to go out. I had done, by that point, that was my eighth or ninth issue. I had done something that previous editors had never been able to do, which is get the magazine out on time. So if I had a strength coming into the process, it was at least hitting my deadlines. But I just didn't understand the company or what the environment needed from a gaming magazine at the time to really sustain it.
So what was different about the magazine from the others in the market at the time? Usually when you're something's popular, there's something different than everything else.
By issue 54, it had become kind of stale and routine. There wasn't as much independence or anything unique about it at that point. When it first came upon the scene, looking back all the way to issue 15, which is when I first appeared as a writer in the magazine was doing fun stuff, really, really fun stuff. It treated the gaming industry like a hobby and not like an industry. No offense to Scott Herring, but when he did The Gamer, which was a newspaper-style magazine way back in the day, he definitely treated gaming like an industry. And that was one of the things that made his newspaper fun to read, but it also made it something very disposable. Once you got your news sound bites, you were done with it and you could throw this thing away.
Jim, I have to agree with you on that in that sense, because as a consumer of both of those magazines, you know, that's a pretty accurate description of The Gamer. I love The Gamer, but you could tell obviously that something was amiss with that magazine, only in the sense because it went through so many different forms. First, you know, it was a glossy, and then it became more of a newspaper style. And it definitely something was going on, you know, that maybe it wasn't big enough for it. Yeah, but Chase, you're right with what you're saying. Yeah.
There was a magazine that's called Space Gamer for years. Anybody could, if you paid the licensing fee, could pick up Space Gamer. I think it went through four different game companies. And Space Gamer was one of those ones that the last incarnation was picked up by Better Games, which was, trying to remember their names now, Red and Conrad were the two owners of Better Games. And they put out Space Gamer, and they had done something with it, which was a free role-playing game on every issue, which was, I thought, was so fantastic. And it saddens me to this day that I didn't carry on that love of Space Gamer into Shadus when I was doing Shadus. I think I was just so overwhelmed with what I was doing and sort of awestruck that, holy crap, I'm working in the gaming industry, that I never once got my boots on.
That is a really cool concept with having the free game every issue.
And the games that they were giving out, I mean, I had been playing them anyway because Better Games was a local game company. But getting them in that nice, pretty, glossy format with the nice type, it was really something to get as opposed to the little printout paper photocopies that they would give you at the cons for $5 that just felt so, you know, slapped together. It was such an improvement over what you'd been playing.
I want to ask your opinion on something, because this is something where I have an opinion, but my opinion is also tainted by what I do. Do you think you will ever see a resurgence of the printed physical gaming magazine?
You know, we were just having this conversation at AAG today, because we still do something called the Imperial Herald, which is a newspaper print newsletter that we do talking about the Legend of the Five Rings CCG, which, I don't know if you guys know this or not, is still in circulation. It's still doing incredibly well. It's the longest lasting CCG next to Magic.
I gotta say, I was in a hobby shop about a year ago, and I knew the hobby shop owner, and I was always going in the back room and stuff, and he held up a box, and it's a long, narrow cardboard box, and I'm like, what the hell is that? He's like, this is the prize support for the L5R card game. I'm like, what the hell is it? And he takes it out, and it's this green katana, like a real one, like a real sword. And I'm like,
I've got it within arm's length of me, actually. I've got that katana.
Like, why didn't I get into this card game? That is awesome.
Because the Aliens versus Predator one was really damn cool.
It was really damn cool. And I and one other guy were the only people in St. Louis who played it. And there was no katanas.
Yeah.
So it was lame.
Well, you could have gotten like a smart gun, but they didn't do that either. Yeah. And it card faded, I guess is what you'd call it. But I ask about that because as someone who produces a podcast, produces an RPG blog, and I look at a lot of the other guys that are doing what we do, taking on this whole new media thing, that it seems like something that the internet communities offer is an immediacy and an intimacy that a print magazine can't offer. And as much as people spoke so sentimentally about Dungeon and Dragon and all these other magazines that have gone the way of the dodo, and I know there's exceptions. For example, I know Pathfinder or whatever the exact Paizo magazine is doing pretty well and such. But they're almost the exception that prove the rule. People may look back fondly, but that sentiment never turns into actual purchases. And the people that want that kind of content, now instead of belonging to some distant fan club, or instead of trying to get their article into whatever magazine or what have you, now instead go onto a blog, they go onto a forum, they pick up a podcast. There's something they can connect with more directly.
The renaissance of gaming is over, and we'll probably get into indie gaming in just a minute because Chris and I talked so much about this at Gen Con. But even indie gaming, in my opinion, isn't a renaissance. But the renaissance of gaming is over. We're in the postmodern age now where everybody can strip away the veneer of everything that they play. They can see the guts. They can see the moving parts. And everybody understands game design theory without even really knowing the terminology that goes with it. If we were left in a room for a week and we weren't let out until we finished designing a game, we would come up with one. We would just be able to do that with or without any kind of training or industry know-how. And I think that adds to the problem of this this intimacy and this immediacy is that a magazine, I got to wait a month for it to come out. The news is outdated by the time I get it. And then it's telling me things that I probably either could have figured out on my own or the editor's opinion is so mundane because he's trying to target so many people with his attitude that nobody really cares. The internet supports fringe theories. And so if I have a fringe theory about gaming, I'll just go to a site that likes to shout at the same decibel that I'm shouting.
Yeah, that's very true. There's no break-even point. A typical blog is free.
Yeah.
A magazine is not. You have to sell so many copies to so many people to even make it a break-even, much less profitable endeavor.
Right.
Whereas I can go put up a blog for free, and if only 10 people tune in, it doesn't really change at all what's going on my end.
Let's use Kim Mohan's Dragon. I think it's Mohan or Mohan. His version of Dragon eons ago was the greatest thing out there. The way he put the magazine together, the content. There was the free NPC of the month. Every single issue of Dragon, you'd get a new class. And, of course, it was an NPC class, so the GM had to approve it if you wanted to use it in the game, but everybody played it as a character class. And it was the only place that you could turn to get more juicy bits like that for D&D. If Dragon Magazine came back right now and did a free character class every month, how would that be unique? Everybody's got a free NPC class or free character class on their website. Or if you pick up a third-party book, they're not going to even release a book without free feats. Not free, but feats or skills clusters or whatever. All this stuff that 30 years ago was caviar is now Cheetos.
Yeah. Almost every group that I've ever known always has at least one guy who's trying to push the rules to some edge and make make a character class that doesn't exist. I mean, people don't need a magazine for that sort of stuff anymore.
Well, I think the one thing that a magazine did is I remember as I was going through high school, having to write term papers, that they would say, well, you have to cite sources for everything. And of course, the thing that I'm thinking in the back of my head through all this was a book written by a regular human being who puts his pants on one leg at a time anyway. Who's to say that just because it's in a book, it's true? But at least at that point in time, that was the thinking. If it's in a book, it's true. And right. If I could walk into a gaming group and here's an official magazine that has it in there. You have to let me play it because it's an official part of the published universe.
But what, well, now but what most of those magazines aren't. Most of those magazines were independent.
You're damn right. Yeah. I'm not disagreeing.
Oh, it put weight behind the artist.
Making it through an editor and into print gave it a form of legitimacy.
Precisely. Yeah. Whereas now, if I wanted to turn these zingers into an official monster,
I approve.
I can publish that on feartheboot.com, and all of a sudden somebody can print it off and say, see, it's a published zinger monster.
I want somebody to give me Savage World stats for a zinger. But Jim, do you think that the changes like this then, I mean, would you consider, I mean, is that necessarily a bad thing? Is this a kind of an expected evolution of the whole process and the hobby itself then?
I think it's an expected evolution of all hobbies. I mean, let's pretend you're a TV show fan. In the 70s, you had TV Guide telling you what to think of chips, and that was your outlet for learning about what was going on in the set of chips. And now, if you want to know anything about Lost, there's 800 forums online. This immediacy, going back to the magazine discussion about the gaming industry, magazines provide one more thing, or they used to provide one more thing for gamers, which was sort of a support or this loving, nurturing feeling of, hey, you play D&D, and that's great. Here's stuff to make you feel good about playing D&D. Here's all these warm fuzzies every month. And there's just details, minutiae, in every corner of every page for you to...
And still no girlfriend.
But just to make sure I'm following you on this point, I want you to finish it. But just to make sure I'm following you, is what you're saying that one of the things these magazines offered was the sense that you and your gaming group aren't alone?
Yeah, exactly.
And online communities have completely replaced that.
I didn't game until 81. And nobody believes me when I say this, but I honestly never played a hack and slash Monty Hall style campaign. I didn't run into those kind of people. We moved a lot and I had trouble finding gaming groups. And by the time I got to college, I'd been in four different sporadic groups that played four different ways. So I never really knew that that's what D&D really was about, how people were playing it. So that aspect of the game, those kind of warm fuzzies that you would get reading Knights of the Dinner Table, where they're making fun of hack and slashers pounding their way through a dungeon, I don't get those same kind of warm fuzzies reading Knights of the Dinner Table. I don't get it, but I know that people do, so I understand its appeal. If I were to go back and look at what was going on in the 80s with Dragon Magazine and see why that it felt good to be reading that magazine and what it was doing to support your ideas, I think the immediacy of the internet now is just that you don't have to wait a month to feel good about playing D&D. You can feel good about playing D&D right now. We just finished our adventure, and I'm going to go online. I'm going to blog about it. I'm going to tell everybody what we did. I'm going to tell them about the monsters we killed. And then I'm going to go to Gleemax.com, which I think is dead now. But yeah. I'm going to go to Gleemax now and see if anybody
nothing
else...
Nothing of value was lost.
I'm going to see if anybody else had any fun with this, you know, room A7 of this adventure.
I hear you saying that, and I see that within our own Fear the Boot forum communities. We get countless people who tell us, I haven't gamed in years. I don't have a gaming group because there's none around me. I can't do it. I move around a lot. You know, whatever their various reasons are. You know, I have 10 kids, whatever.
I'm in prison.
Well, you know, you can find a gaming
group.
Busy
stalking someone.
I got all my time. Sorry. But they say that they love listening to our podcast and other podcasts about gaming because they get that feeling that they're at least part of the whole gaming thing. They like being on our forums and other forums because they are surrounded with gamers and they can talk about gaming. They like reading blogs and stuff about that. And it seems to me that before the internet hit, magazines provided that. And then they also provided other stuff for people who were gaming.
Well, I could even remember, Chad, to go along with that, going back to 1992, the first time.
I don't remember.
I know you don't. You don't remember
902. 902
yesterday.
This morning.
But the very first gaming convention we went to, you know, Archon here in St. Louis, back when it was at the King Henry VIII Hotel. And when we walked in there, the first thing that blew us away. Mm-hmm. Was holy crap, we're not the only two people out there to do this.
Yeah, because our entire world up to that point was we had found gaming like on a bookstore shelf. I mean, I don't want to get into the stories of how we got into gaming, but you know, we found gaming and then we clawed people into our group and we got a couple of lucky finds. And then it was just us. We were this island of people that gamed. And then we went to the major St. Louis convention. And yeah, we were surrounded. And everybody was older than us, and it was really creepy. But
if it wasn't for the forums and the community and the podcast community and all of this, I might even feel that way right now. Because, I mean, if I look, I don't know anyone outside of our close circle that even knows what gaming is unless we've told them.
Mm-hmm. Go to Gen Con. You blow your socks off. An entire city devoted to gaming. To me, that's the opposite extreme, is something like Gen Con. The entire town turns into gaming central for 4 days.
Jim, I want to ask you to explain a phrase you used a couple minutes ago, which is that the renaissance of gaming is over. What exactly do you mean by that?
I like his postmodern gaming.
Thanks. I don't know if I've coined those or not. I don't know if I picked them up along the way. I can't.
Well, you did. Well, it's, now that you've said them on Fear the Boot, you have coined them, so you can take full and complete credit for it.
You get a nickel each time somebody says it.
So 73 is when D&D made its appearance, and even before that, you had the Bookcase Games by Avalon Hill, and I was a fetus at the time. That stuff was big. So I didn't really get into gaming until 81, and I'd read in that Scholastics book in my elementary school, I'd read about D&D and I'd heard about it through the grapevine, but I hadn't seen it, so I didn't play it until I got to junior high school. The only thing I knew was D&D, and then I picked up an issue of Dragon, you know, maybe a year later, and then I'm thumbing through Dragon and I'm seeing some of these other games out. Sky Realms of Jeroen sticks out as one of the better ones, Empire of the Petal Throne, Car Wars. What I call the renaissance of gaming is that you didn't have to make a great game, you just had to make a game that nobody else had made. And so I'll use Steve Jackson's The Street Fight, where you're fighting in Iran to free the hostages, that little bookcase game that he did for $5. It wasn't a great game, but if you wanted to free the hostages, that was the only game that you could play that would allow you to do that.
It was timely.
And then Star Wars would eventually come out in the mid-80s, and then Vampire comes out, and I think Vampire is the end of the Renaissance. And I'll explain what I mean by that is that up until that point, gaming was made for nerds. All of us collectively lavishly loving details and all this nerdly stuff in our hobby before nerds became cool like they are now in mainstream media, you had this renaissance going on where anything that we liked, somebody would eventually put out a game for it and we would eat it up. The Ghostbusters role-playing game strikes me as one of those kinds of things.
They're saying like low production values, low quality as far as production goes, maybe not the gameplay itself, but it's out there and it's available and people are just churning out role-playing games. And if you like a particular concept or IP, chances are is if you at least wait a couple of months, somebody will put something out.
Right, right. You know, Da Vinci's one of the few guys we remember from the Renaissance. He's the guy that sticks out in everybody's mind. But there were other inventors and artists and creators going on during the Renaissance. So you have to imagine during the Renaissance that people were just crapping out statues. Because people wanted statues.
Ouch.
That sounds painful.
And so the 80s come along, and somebody makes RuneQuest, which stands as one of the greatest games of the 20th century to critics and a lot of gamers alike. That stands out as a monument to the time period. But who remembers the Succession Wars board game for BattleTech?
You're asking the wrong crowd.
Funny you should mention that, because I'm at a convention of, 25,000 gamers, and I'm walking around with my Succession Wars board game in front of my chest, carrying it around in the open gaming area. And
like
no
some
one,
holy relic.
And yeah, well, and no one is like, hey, cool, or oh, are you going to play? Nobody said that. So that's exactly
anybody
right.
Called anyone else cool at Gen Con. I'm sorry, but
you guys could do a whole vlog about that.
Happened.
The leftover games that nobody wanted to play with me.
Fear the Con, too, though. The Succession Wars game filled up really quickly.
But you know what, though? But that's a might. See, now, in that particular example,
I could gush about
Wayne,
Succession Wars.
It's I would refer to that. That's very, it's kind of a microcosm. Because of the crowd that we hang around in, and because I pimped it and pimped it and pimped it, and so I got people interested in doing it, and Chad helped with that as well. He expressed interest of it to this larger crowd, but it was the same size drop, but in a much smaller pond. You do the same size drop in an ocean like Gen Con, you don't get any response. But anyway, go ahead, Jim, keep going.
If I want to make a game popular, I just have to get you to pimp it.
And Chad, yes.
It couldn't hurt.
Pimp my game.
Pimp your game.
Just mention it on here. Apparently, this is where you get noticed. This is where Zingers got noticed.
That's right.
Zingers were nowhere to be found. Nowhere. You could get them Zingers in PDF format, and that was it.
That was it. Yeah.
The good old days of PDF Zingers.
I found it on some Norwegian torrent one time, and that's how I got first into Zingers.
And only thing, because it was bundled with barnyard porn. And
exactly. I'm like, who put this in here? Well, I'll give it a try. I'm already watching goats. Boom. And I've downloaded Zingers right into my mouth.
Wow. That sounds like a metaphor.
So, right, so back to the death of the Renaissance of gaming.
Did I totally derail this whole interview?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I am mightier than
you
that.
You aroused some of us. Is that okay?
I do what I can.
But, okay, so I follow what you're saying. So you have this point in gaming where basically there's a vacuum, and anybody doing anything is doing it for the first time.
There was a lot of crap, but it was a lot of fun crap.
Yeah.
And a lot of crap that people enjoyed making and enjoyed playing.
I think I can get away with bashing Talisman, even though there's a cult following out there that loves it and will come to my house and burn me at the stake. But I don't like Talisman. Talisman is a board game. It came out late 70s, Games Workshop, long before they were doing miniatures. And it was supposed to replicate, you know, an entire campaign of gaming in 6 hours. I don't remember anybody being able to play the original game in less than 6 hours. And it was just a big quest. And you've got one character and he's going around and around and around this board Monopoly style, which made no sense. And you would roll a die and then choose left or right. So that the only decision you would make is, do I want to go there and draw a card or there and draw a card? And then if a monster killed somebody, the monster stayed on that space face up with all that guy's stuff there. So you could eventually come by and fight that monster. But if a monster killed some other guy, chances are he's going to kill you. So you have to go around and find enough widgets so that you get powerful enough to kill the monsters to get bigger widgets and so on.
Yeah, I've heard of the game. I've never seen it. Didn't know. This is the most I've ever heard about it. But I've heard of its following and that its following is huge. Well, not huge, but very zealotous, very fanatical.
Yeah,
following.
And so Talisman becomes the first board game of its type. It becomes a board game reflecting how it is that everybody's playing D&D, at least in their minds, how they see it going down. And so it's, I don't want to say it's the holy grail of board games, but it certainly has sold more copies than, you know, Sherlock Holmes. It's in that category of board game in that it's sold thousands and thousands of copies. It's on its fifth incarnation, and they just keep selling it out the gate every time they print it again. And I see it now, and I see people playing it, and I have to wonder, you know, why is this popular? And it's popular because it was the first one on the market. Which brings me to Vampyr, which is sort of, this is where the Renaissance of gaming ends, in my opinion, is that Vampyr comes along and it does two things. One, it does something to gaming which had never been done before, which is you're not playing an adventurer going out and finding stuff and getting better and better equipment so you can fight better and better stuff. It was the first game to not do that. And secondly, it was the first game to not target nerds, but instead bring people into the fold of nerddom. It went out and found people that were dark and gloomy and gothy and say, look how cool it is to stand around and pretend you're a vampire.
You know, it's also the only game I know of that got a primetime TV show.
Oh, God, that was awful.
D&D only got a Saturday morning cartoon.
D&D got a cartoon, yeah.
I watched that Vampire the Masquerade TV show. I don't think it was called Vampire the Masquerade. It was Vampire something. But I watched it, and it was so bad. It was like watching a train wreck. You can't take your eyes off it. I even actually tuned back in and watched two or three episodes of it because I knew it was, this is going to be so god awful. There's this morbid curiosity. Can it get worse?
If you've ever seen the movie Videodrome.
I have, actually.
It was like that. It was like experiencing the Videodrome.
So would you say that Vampyr, did they maybe raise the bar for everyone else and make it to where you just couldn't put out crap that was fun? You had to put out something that was high quality and fun?
Or did they move the bar to the right?
You finally weren't competing against your own incompetence as a designer anymore. I think in the 80s, if you wanted to sell the Star Wars role-playing game, all you had to do was not have boogers inside the box, and you were going to sell Star Wars, right? I mean, that system was kind of clunky but fun for what it was, and yet they sold 150,000 copies of that box set, if I'm quoting my numbers correctly, which is an astronomical amount in an age where D&D is king. Yeah. Vampyr comes along, and Vampyr's pulling people into the industry. It's getting the attention of people inside the industry, and all of a sudden people are seeing that books can be works of art. Mm-hmm. You know, choosing fonts and getting good artists are all important to the process of making a book.
Doing creative things with the layouts,
right,
instead of just single column pamphlet with one staple in the middle.
Using quotes from rock and roll songs as chapter headers.
Right, right. And so after Vampire comes out, you go from being able to sell 50,000 copies of Star Wars or Tales from the Crypt board game, which a box set, I don't even think they sold 50,000, I'm just picking a number, to you're only going to be guaranteed 2,000 copies if you release your and I'll use Kingdom of the Calamar as a perfect example, because that is one game setting that actually did sell well. But I think its sales were pretty slow to begin with because they didn't have a lot of marketing and they were yet another book on the shelf. You have this era happening now between, I'll say, 87 and 93 when Magic's about to come out, where role-playing games are still going to be able to sell, but very minimal amounts because everybody's seen it all before. And why would I stop playing Vampire to play that?
Mm-hmm.
I think people are finally starting to ask that question about themselves. Their time is starting to get more valuable. We see the stock market crash of 87, which made people start watching their wallets of how much money they were going to spend on stuff. Comic books, the 17 different covers for comic books had pretty much jaded all of us about the process of being gouged simply because we were nerds and we were willing to spend a lot of our liquid income on junk we didn't need. So a lot of things came together at the same time, and gaming starts to become it becomes an endeavor that we want to spend our time doing, but we don't want to empty our bank accounts to do.
You know, I've always found it kind of funny that it's right after this big drop, right after the early 90s drop where the bubble burst on so many of these industries, that's when it became popular to be a geek. That's when geek really hit its chic, was after it collapsed and a lot of this extraneous stuff was wiped away.
Well, I fully believe it's one thing that changed that. This is a correlation without causality, which is video games. If video game systems suddenly became affordable, ubiquitous, diverse, and that's what I think really allowed the geek chic. And these video games oftentimes alluded to more geeky properties. You had Batman video games and DuckTales video games.
I'm not sure if it was video games or computers, though. Because computers, and well, once computers hit mainstream, they became the internet. Because there's both around the same time.
Well, right. But my point being that, okay, fair enough. Maybe it was the internet as well. But it was changes in technology that were already popular in our niche. And so as they became mainstream, some influence of our niche bled out into that.
That's a great way to put it.
And created the geek chic. But so let's keep following this analogy. And I'm just going to skip over the Baroque and Romantic and all these other periods. And we're just going to skip straight to the postmodern era of gaming. Jim, I'm going to put words in your mouth and then you can tell me why I'm right or wrong. But is the way that you see it now that with gaming, there will probably be a new idea that comes along eventually, but for the most part, particularly with the indie market, the PDF market, anything that could be done has been done. What people are really looking for now is the incarnation that's either done best or done best by their standards, as opposed to really looking for the next big thing.
I think that's pretty close to what I'm saying. Yeah, I think for a long time, Gen Con, if we're going to continue with the Renaissance motif, Gen Con is the mecca of gaming. It is where all gamers go to gather and bow at the stone and pretty much get the juice that's going to get them through the year to the next Gen Con. And they, what's the new thing that's coming out? This, that, and the other thing. I'll use the Pirates little collectible ship game that I forget the name of the company now, but James Ernest designed it. And you pop out the pieces and you build your little pirate ship.
Yeah, it's the High Seas.
Pirates of the Cursed Sea.
Pirates of the Cursed Sea.
And it was done by
WizKids, wasn't it?
Was it WizKids? Yep.
That was one of the ones they've dropped.
We were pimping it really hard at Fear the Con, too, after it was out of print.
Yes, yes. Well, somebody, a couple of people sent us, like, tons and tons and tons of those cards because we mentioned that, yeah, we're getting into this and we really like it, and man, it's hard to find cards. And then a couple of fans like, here, I don't play anymore. Here's 500 unpunched cards. And so we just gave them all out.
And we generated a ton of new players for a game that doesn't even
exist.
And people loved it. That's a whole other thing. It's like people love this game, yet they canceled it.
If you look at that as a spike of innovation, and it was considered an innovation, if you consider it a spike of innovation, it's a long time before we see another spike of innovation. It's not that short before the previous spike of innovation, which I guess would be Mage Knights. And before that, it would have been a collectible card game that had some other kind of thing to it, maybe the first one that had a license or whatever. You see these spikes at Gen Con where people get in line for something. And those are usually a pretty good indication of something innovative that's going on in the industry. We haven't seen lines forming at Gen Con since 3.5, really.
What do you consider to be, you know, quote unquote, a line? Because this year I noticed that, like, the lines, say, for Pathfinder, which was, you know, there 3.75, let's call it, and right. the line that was for War Machine, and the lines that Fantasy Flight have come out, which is another angle I kind of want to talk to you about in regards to board games, because I noticed that Alderac seems to be going in the board game direction. Fantasy Flight, yeah. which produced a lot of RPGs, is now doing, I mean, you almost know them more for board games now than you do.
Oh, absolutely. They're the biggest board game company in the industry right now. Yeah, you absolutely.
Know, so, I mean, what do you consider to be a line? Because I would have considered those to be, you know, lines. The only other line that I saw was when Jerry Ryan was at Gen Con and was doing autograph signings.
We had a line of maybe 50 people at our booth for Adventures.
I really wanted to because that game looks sweet, by the way.
Yeah, and it is. And it won't be in stores again, I don't think, for another couple of months. So people that got it at the show are loving it. But I don't think a 50-person line is a line on scale with WizKids when they had Mage Knights. What was the follow-up to Mage Knights? HeroClix. The year that HeroClix peaked there, they had a Brinks truck arriving every single day to collect money at their booth. Because they were making so much money at that.
And I'd have to say, even the Paizo had a huge line, right? But the first day, the first half of the day.
Well, but even then, I think in a sense...
And they didn't even sell all their books.
That almost proves the point we're getting at. Because as Chris said, what was the product they were offering? It's an updated version of Pathfinder. It's D&D, what he's calling 3.75. This is not a new breakthrough idea. Yeah. This is a refinement, a polishing, a new incarnation of an existing idea.
What's War Machine selling? More War Machine.
Yeah.
Different flavors of War Machine now.
And even then, what's War Machine except it's another tabletop
miniatures game.
Yeah. It's an innovative, in all fairness, it's an innovative miniatures game. I mean, it is a game where saying you only need to buy 10 miniatures and you're done.
Well, right. But we've got love for War Machine, so I'm not bashing War Machine. But it's just more what I'm saying is that it's not like I'm walking up to a booth and saying, I have never seen anything like this before. This type of product just was not there before.
Right. There's all kinds of theories as to why this is happening, right? One could be there's not enough money in the industry and nobody wants to take the risk. The other theory is that we're just out of ideas, right? The collectible market was spawned.
Close the copyright office.
It spawned so many ideas that everybody's done every kind of collectible thing that there is except for collectibles. I mean, I guess you could do collectible money as the next big collectible thing, but that's what else is there to collect that you can still play? Zingers, the collectible Zinger game.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess doing Legend of the Five Rings, you might be collecting fingers if you guys want to do like an organized crime spinoff or something.
I can't pinpoint exactly why we're not seeing those kind of spikes anymore at Gen Con, but it's been a long time since we've seen one, and we notice it every year that we're at Gen Con that there's nothing as innovative as there was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. When 3.0 came out, people loved gaming again. People stopped worrying about how unbalanced D&D was or how little sense it made, and everybody just wanted to make characters again and play again. And games that get you back to the nostalgia of loving what you do are probably always going to sell better than a game that tries to take you on some innovative curve into an area of gaming, not role-playing necessarily, but any kind of gaming that you've never explored before. And this is why I don't think indie games is a renaissance. I'm finally bringing this full circle. If indie games were a renaissance, more people would feel comfortable doing it. But indie role-playing games are not for everyone. And as a result, they're sort of they're fringe. They're a fringe craft.
We'll swing at the indie market here in a second. Before I get to that, the question I want to ask you that you may have just answered, but I want to ask it specifically because you may want to expound on your answer, is as someone who's actively involved in a gaming company who seems resigned to the fact that we are no longer in the Renaissance, we're no longer in this golden age of gaming, what is the business model? What's the plan? When you guys sit down, what is it that you guys are hoping to do?
It's different for different kinds of games, right? A CCG has a much different business model than a role-playing game or a board game. So all three of those business models are completely different. In fact, I can't imagine someone building a business model right now for a role-playing game. If Paizo weren't owned by people that already had a lot of money and could support that game for its longevity, it could not succeed. there's no way you could do Pathfinder as a grassroots marketing game. You couldn't start it in your garage and expect it to succeed.
Because it already had a pre-existing audience is part of the reason why it's as successful as it is, and because Wizards abandoned 3.5 as well.
Well, and you would never be able to make it look as good or edit it as well as you can with the money and marketing machine that Paizo has. If you guys were doing it out of your garage, you would only have X amount of dollars you could spend on art and on editing and on printing to get that thing done. You wouldn't be able to afford to do it in color. And you'd have to consider just doing it as a PDF so that you don't have any risk to your business model. And I don't think a 3.75 PDF would sell as well as having the book right in front of you that you can touch, because that group that wants 3.75 is old school gamers that want a book at the table. So to answer your question about building a business model, it's very different based on what you're doing. It really is. I think now that we're getting into board games, we're seeing that it has a much longer curve in terms of sales and profitability than a CCG does, which has very narrow bands of we print it, and within 3-6 months, we make all the money we're going to make on that expansion because we've already moved on to the next expansion. CCGs are much different in that model. And role-playing games, I think your success is based on so many factors that you couldn't calculate with a business model. There's just too much risk involved. There's a company putting out Eclipse Phase called Catalyst Games. I wish them the best of luck. It looks gorgeous. It looks really interesting. But I can't imagine putting out a role-playing game like that in today's market.
But even them, too, even Catalyst is also embracing other gaming types, you know, and the card games and a little bit of board games are also becoming, you know, part of their table of things. It's not just solo RPGs. And so they obviously must be seeing some of the same things that you are. In a certain sense, you're diversifying because you can't continue to cannibalize the same audience.
Right.
You have to try and bring in new people. Adventurers to me, and I didn't get to do a demo or anything, but just looking at like the cover art and some of the things I saw, that game to me looks like it could be easily adaptable to a family style game.
Yeah,
which absolutely suddenly broadens it for me. I got 4 kids. This could be something that we could do.
Our hope obviously is to get it in places like Target and Toys R Us and that sort of thing. You know, that's a goal with a product like that. But to compare, let's say Eclipse Phase to, I don't know. Let's look at Pathfinder for instance, or how about a license, some sort of licensed product. You have a role playing game that you're putting out like Eclipse Phase, which you're using to support so many other ideas, that if it is part of your business model, that we don't care if it just breaks even or even if it's a loss leader. Our objective is to sell a screenplay associated with this product because we have a healthy world that we built around it, and maybe we can turn it into a TV show, maybe we can turn it into a movie, maybe we can turn it into a cartoon. If that is your objective in making that product, then that business model works simply because your investors know that they're taking a small risk in order to get this thing turned into a video game or turn it into a cartoon for Saturday morning. But if you're taking something like Pathfinder, which doesn't have a license associated with it, doesn't have a world associated really. It has one, but it's not anything different from Lord of the Rings. Every fantasy world out there is just a derivative of Lord of the Rings. Those are much harder to sell. Those are much harder to turn into screenplays and throw on the big screen. There's a reason the Dungeons & Dragons movies didn't sell outside of Dungeons & Dragons fans. Because
they were awful. I mean, that's the reason.
The writing was awful. I'm not going to even get into that. But there's no world associated with it that is really innovative or interesting to your standard moviegoer.
People who have jobs that involve killing other people and the monsters that need to be killed. That is the plot, world, and setting of D&D.
Yeah,
yeah, and add in a whole lot of incoherence and blue lipstick, and yeah, that was the D&D movie.
No, that's just them spicing up the existing world.
All right, so Jim, we keep hedging around it, then getting tangented off.
That's all right.
What is your take on the indie market?
First of all, let me just say that there are 3 or 4 indie games, that the indie role-playing games, that I just think kick major ass. I love them so much. They've replaced my library of games, and I never want to play anything else. I want to sell my clothes and become a hippie and live in the wild and just play Dogs in the Vineyard. They're that good, in my opinion. But those are, again, it's the same kind of thing I was talking about with the Renaissance of the 80s, is there's such a glut of games that while Gray Ranks may be this great, awesome game, it takes 100 indie games that merely stink and make your eyes hurt in order to get to that great game like Gray Ranks.
And it's hard to find it through all of those.
Right. And I shouldn't say stinks because that's unfair. They're just not for me. There's so many of these games that just aren't for me. I'm on a bunch of different mailing lists and forums, and I see the vernacular being used by these designers just to describe the process of playtesting their games. And I feel like I'm reading Klingon. I don't know what's being said. It reminds me of the old Immortal role-playing game where instead of rolling dice, you were engaging motes of Immaculum. He went out of his way to find new ways to say things that are old hat. You know, and there's only a couple of terms that I picked up from the indie market that I continue to use because I find them convenient, not because I find that they're going to replace the language that I've been using.
A lot of the perception is that indie games are leading the forefront of innovation in the hobby. Do you think that maybe that's not true and that the majority, not all of them, but the majority of indie games are simply the same old thing, using different words and perhaps putting on airs of snobbiness?
We throw a quote around the office a lot, and I know this is going to sound horrible because Jerry Bruckheimer made a lot of stinky movies over his career, but Jerry Bruckheimer once said, "It is not my job to create art. It is my job to put butts in seats." And I think so long as indie gamers keep treating this like a hobby and keep making games for the fun of it, they're always going to be innovative. They're always going to be coming out with stuff that nobody else would think of because they can afford to. Mm-hmm. But it is my job to put butts in seats. So when I design a board game or when I'm developing somebody else's idea for a board game, I've got to trim the fat from that thing. I've got to make the game accessible to as many people as possible. And I've got to find a way to either fill it with so many crunchy components that you're willing to spend $100 for it, or I've got to trim down the components to nothing so that I can get $25 out of your pocket. These are things that an indie role-playing developer never has to worry about, never has to think about when he's designing a game. If he wants to create some new wacky tool for his game, that's the player's problem to solve and how he's going to come up with a 13-sided die.
So when you're creating games, do you ever put any thought towards how do you bring new people into the hobby? How do you get the new, you know, the new customer versus the existing already won over audience?
There are people that do that. I am not one of them. I'm just no good at that. I'm my own kind of gamer. I know what I like. I know what I like playing, and I have a wide range of taste when it comes to board games, but I still would never want to make a Monopoly variant. I'll never want to make something online with Stratego or Sorry. I don't think those are very good games.
What about when it comes to outreach type efforts like that, where Pathfinder has its Pathfinder Society, Wizards had the RPGA, and it still somewhat exists today. Catalyst has demo teams and other, or the Commandos, I believe is what they call it for Battletech.
Sure.
But, you know, all these companies have at least some sort of outreach, something like that. Does Alderac engage in that kind of activity? Do they even see a benefit in that kind of activity?
Well, I'm going to go as far on a limb as to say that we're the innovators of that. We were one of the first companies to create what we called the Bounty Hunter Program, which was our demo team. This was going on 8 years ago, 10 years ago. We were sending people out to stores to teach people how to play all of our product. And you would get free product for demoing games to people. And so that model worked for a really long time until the teams grew so big that you had people just doing it just to get free product, not because they loved our stuff. And once it grew to that point, it stopped being as effectual for us as it used to be because we were giving away more than we were selling.
As someone who has a strong corporate background outside of gaming, I've been put through more courses on industrial models and such than I care to recount. But one of the little case studies they gave us was on grocery stores. When you go to build a grocery store, you have to accept from the start that you are not generating new customers. Everybody out there eats. Everybody out there is either already going to a grocery store or some hippie that grows their own food and doesn't want to ever go to a grocery store anyway.
You're providing a need, not a want.
Well, and on top of that, the only way that you are going to succeed is by stealing somebody else's customer. I'm going to go into a neighborhood where right now they have to drive 2 miles over to a grocery store, and I'm going to put one right in the middle of their neighborhood. So now they have to drive a quarter mile to a grocery store, and they'll stop going to that one 2 miles away and start coming to me. And it seems like, and I've seen this all over the gaming industry, not just within the people that put out the role-playing games, but the people that make the podcasts, the people that make the blogs, that there seems to be this sort of unspoken malaise, this feeling that we have topped out as a market. And so really all we're going to go after anymore is somebody else's customers, that we're not trying anymore, really, at least on any concerted high dollar or high man hour level, to bring somebody new in to create more demand. But instead, I'm just trying to figure out how to take the other guy's customers.
That is 95% true, what you're talking about. But gaming doesn't exist on a typical business model. If I owned a game company, I wouldn't have to worry about the same things that somebody that owns an auto parts store has to worry about. I'm part of a hobby. I'm not part of a necessity. So you're only going to spend 17 to 20% of your income on food as a consumer. This is a verifiable number. You can go and look it up. But that's how much you as an American spend on food. And you're going to spend that going out to eat. You're going to spend that going to the market. But you're eventually just going to stop going into your pocket to buy food because you're tapped out and you don't want to. And so you'll eat ramen for a week if that's what it takes. But gaming is a hobby. And there has been no verifiable study that shows that people will slow down their spending when it comes to a hobby. Now, if they're unemployed, they're obviously only going to have a fraction of an income of what they used to be able to spend on a hobby. But I've seen unemployed people still go into game stores and plop down $20 a week on a new book because it's their hobby and that's what they need to do. It just does not follow the same algorithms that all other business models follow.
You and I had talked a little bit about, and we talked about Pathfinder already a little bit, but it seemed, you know, one of the things I noticed at Gen Con this year was Pathfinder did have this big line, and yes, it was, you know, pretty much the big first day, but they still had good sales of their book. And the Wizards line for 4E really wasn't that huge. And I don't know, it just, when you looked at that situation, that all these people are kind of going after a rule system that was abandoned, as compared to the number of people that were going after this new rule system, it seemed like there was some sort of awkwardness. And you actually kind of referred to, we talked about the 4E and its success, but you referred to it in a different way, that it was more of a successful book as opposed to a successful game.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought this up, because 4E is a completely different animal. 4E is owned by WotC, which is owned by Hasbro. And Hasbro is bringing a typical industry business model to the success or failure of D&D. D&D has to sell so many units or they're just going to stop doing it. And so they've done the numbers, they've crunched it, and they saw that the best-selling books in the third edition and the 3.5 line were anything with character classes, anything with monsters. So already 4E's only been out for a few years, and we're already seeing Player's Handbook 2, DM's Guide 2, Monster Manual 2, Fiend Folio 7, whatever they can do to continue to put those kind of books in front of you that they know are going to sell to the core. They don't need to do anything innovative. They don't want to do anything innovative because they need to sell a certain amount of books every month in order to keep that game going. Pathfinder has a little more luxury in that regard. They can take a few more chances, and they can do fun things with their game line that 4th edition can't. And so, yeah, I think at an event like Gen Con, which is a haven for gamers and not book consumers, absolutely you're going to see a bigger line for 3.75 than you would for 4E. Absolutely. But 4E is going to sell in bookstores, Borders, Barnes & Noble, that sort of thing, and it's going to be on the New York Times best-selling list, and 3.75 never will be. Not any fault of their own. It just, it can't.
Speaking of pimping products, one of the things that we do usually allow people to do when we have guests on here, go ahead and take a couple minutes to pimp some stuff from Alderac. And then I want to pimp one of the things that I picked up at Gen Con this year as well that is an Alderac product. But you go ahead first.
I don't really know what to mention. We're doing so many board games, and I have so many things going on in the future. I really can't mention anything until about April of next year.
We're not going to keep you on the mics that long.
Is there anything coming up about to be released that you want, or something that was just released that for fans of your guys' product lines, this is where you would want to draw their attention?
Or if someone's never bought any of your products, what would be the one thing you'd point to?
And we've mentioned Adventures a couple times, but I doubt that many people know really what it's about. Myself included, even for that matter. So go ahead and...
Then I'm going to mention two products, Adventurers and Thunderstone. Adventurers was made by Dusk Games, which is an Italian/French company And they came to us and said, we want you to be our American distributor of Adventurers. So we had almost zero to do with that product, with the exception of writing up some cool background stories for the characters, getting it translated, getting it edited, and then slapping our name on the box. So Adventurers is the first opening 20 minutes of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. You're going into a temple, stealing as much treasure as you can, and getting out before the boulder crushes you. That's the game. And as simple as that description sounds, it is actually one of the most fun games I think AEG's ever put out. I'm really saddened that we were only the house organ for getting it into stores in the United States. I would have liked to have done more work on it. The other one that I was going to mention is Thunderstone, which is by Mike Elliott. I don't want to say that it's a Dominion clone, but it's in the style of Dominion, in which it's a deck-building game where you have a small stack of cards and you eventually build it into a big stack of cards by buying more cards and making your deck bigger and better so that you can go and fight monsters and kill them. It's the traditional D&D motif of hiring adventurers to go into a dungeon to kill monsters to get bigger treasure so you can kill bigger monsters. But we've done it as a little quick, fast card game slash board game in the style of Dominion. And we are really excited about it. It'll be out in November, and we're already, all the people we've shown it off to, we're already getting a lot of responses. And since I was the developer on that one, I had a lot of input in terms of the art content, the graphic design, the names of things. So I got to help build the world and the elements that are in there. So I'm really proud of that one. So that's one that I actually was hands-on and I got to work on. As for my personal designs, those won't be out until April.
Yeah, one thing I just did want to mention is I picked up a copy of the Ultimate Toolbox, which is this 400-page monstrosity book that you guys put out, which is, and this, I don't know, this Chad, this may or may not make you cringe, but it's essentially, it's an entire book of nothing but tables that you can use to generate everything from a character background to a world itself to a city contents to the contents of a potion, all these kinds of things, where it's just a random assortment. Well, I shouldn't say random because it's actually organized quite nicely. Assortment of tables that has all this information, and though I had not used it yet in a game setting, just looking through it and seeing everything that's in there, in a certain way, it is, this kind of brings us back around to the magazine point that we made earlier. It's kind of cool because it kind of gets you excited to play. It's got that little bit level of detail in there that you're like, oh, you know, that's a neat little aspect to add to this room, or a neat little aspect to add to this NPC description, or to this particular item, that kind of thing. Some of that old school kind of stuff. And I did find one use for this book, though. I mean, apart from the obvious, well, apart from the second obvious as a defensible weapon.
Doorstop.
Holding up the couch.
Place to rest your drink. Emergency
firewood.
Place to
rest your zinger.
Oh, yes. Zinger holder.
Oh, no. There's no resting them. They go straight in the mouth.
That's right.
But I found out this was actually a fun activity to go through and create characters in a story with my 8-year-old daughter. And I went through kind of the character background tables, and I would tell her to pick a number between, 1 through 20 or 1 through 10 or whatever the table or breakdown of tables happened to be. You know, over the course of an hour or so, we generated the names, the background schooling, the motivations, and all kinds of other little aspects of these different people that we just made up on the spot. And she really had a blast doing this, and it was just a good, father-daughter kind of activity.
So I'm going to sound like a really big hypocrite now, because I just spent however many minutes going on and on about the quantifying everything that I can think of about the history of gaming since 73. Yet one of my strengths as a writer and designer is the unquantifiable. And so when Jeff Eibach and I sat down and we made the Ultimate Toolbox, when we made some of these charts, when we made all of these entries to give juice to gaming, it was because there's this unquantifiable quality when you're sitting down at a game table with your friends and there's the five of you and you're engaging in this, I'll call it art for lack of a better word, the process of storytelling or world creation. There's this artistry that goes on, and there's these things that take place while you're playing that you cannot qualify in any way that you could if you were watching a movie. When you sit down and watch the movie, you can review every aspect of watching that movie and say, this movie is good because of the framing. This movie is bad because of the lighting. This movie is great because of the sound. Everything about watching a movie is quantifiable. I think that there's stuff that goes on at a game table that are unquantifiable. And the Ultimate Toolbox is such a great place for more of those unquantifiable ingredients, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, biggest use I would have for it in a game is answering questions I didn't have prepared.
And that's one of the main reasons we made it?
Yeah. Somebody walks into the tavern, the Color Animal Inn, and says, what's the bartender's name? I have no idea.
I always love zinging them with that, too.
Yeah, and so I grab some dice.
That's why I expected that from you. That's why when I ran the game with you, I had a page of nothing but names.
Yeah.
And as he asked me names, I was writing notes next to him. This is what this name is, even though it didn't even matter.
Yeah, the princess is dying. We need to get a potion. Here's what it consists of. And just roll that out. But
yeah, and that's where something, you know, where things like that come in handy, where you can if you, someone like you and me, Dan, who likes to have a lot of notes done beforehand, either a product like this or other things like that, you can set all that stuff up beforehand. So when you get those zingers from Wayne or Chad, then you can move on.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it's a great interview.
And yeah, I want to thank the technology for not failing on us this time.
I know. Woo-hoo! I want to thank...
We want to end this quickly before it changes its mind.
I still have to save my side of the file, so who knows what will happen.
I want to thank Callburn for not being a complete POS like the prior product we were using. Yes. So, anyway, as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.